This morning we're going to do something different because Ngaranoa is known for also for teaching te reo, and I just wanted to talk a bit about your journey with that.
Yes, of course.
And starting from, you know, from the beginning, was te reo something that was present in your life as a child?
It was present, but it was certainly not gifted to us as something that we should be speaking within the household. No, that definitely wasn't put forward to us as you know, to be bilingual.
Yeah.
Not at all.
I've talked to other people who've said that their grandparents' generation actively discouraged the speaking of Māori. They thought that it was not a good idea, some of them.
Yes. However, having said that, both my parents were very clear about making sure that we knew what mana whenua was, ancestral land, and those kinds of challenges that they were experiencing as young parents. I can, you know, looking back, I can see on that in my childhood, there was always things that came up to do with. My father travelled from Hamilton to Kaio to the courthouse regularly to do with ancestral land.
Okay.
And I didn't know until I became an adult. Oh, so he was constantly trying to keep that connection really strong, you know, and we were eventually, as a young family, to move from Hamilton, the heart of Hamilton, back to the far north, closer to both my parents are from Whangaroa in the far north.
Yeah.
To move closer to their parents or the older generation that was still alive then.
Yeah.
Mm. That was important.
So I guess.
But
what,
it was.
Sorry. No. Go ahead.
So it wasn't really until I became an adult and had lived overseas that it struck me that I didn't have command of my own indigenous language. And it was really, I was strongly influenced by the Tibetan. I spent 2 months amongst the Tibetan people who were in exile at that time in Himachal Pradesh. And the Dalai Lama had also come to live there in McLeod Gunj, and I met the Dalai Lama, and I also had contact with Tibetan people who were in exile, and they were very, very, very strong about maintaining their reo, and they shared that with me every day. And that passion.
And did you explain to them that you couldn't speak your reo, you know, in a bilingual sense?
Oh, they knew. They were very, very, very knowledgeable people.
Yeah.
They seemed to have quite a resilience that I could relate to. I thought, wow, they've been thrown out of their own country.
Mm.
And their strength, their resilience was quite clear, how they re-established their community in the foothills of the Himalayas, you know, in India. And I took courage from that, and their passion, to their love for their leader, for their spiritual leader as well, was really quite something that I'd never seen before, from a whole race of people. But I was to learn that there was another very strong connection to the Tibetan people, to the northern Māori. They were actually, there was a whakapapa, a junior, a whakapapa link.
Yeah.
They went to visit Whina Kupa.
Oh, okay.
Up in the Hokianga, and that was revived, that link. Some Tibetan monks visited her in the early 80s. Mm. Yeah.
I think
another story.
Yeah, another one. And there's so many, I think. And I think, too, that like in mainstream Aotearoa, we don't totally have a handle on. I remember being surprised And they thought, oh, no, it's obvious that this, you know, we've been dealing with all the issues of language and land here in this country, but this basic story is repeated all around the world for many cultures and many different countries. And I guess indigenous peoples have been drawing strength from each other in that way quite a lot in the last few decades.
My understanding and my experience has been that Aotearoa New Zealand indigenous people actually lead that.
Right.
We're looked to because of the as a warrior people, not necessarily in the physical sense, but just that warrior nature of discipline and being determined. That determination is other indigenous people have recognised that, and they actually ask for it. How do you do that? Mm. How do you re-establish your early childhood centres so that you are speaking your own language within those settings? And we said, you fight.
Yeah.
You fight. You don't fight with taiaha, with the traditional weapons. You use the mind, you use your mind, and you become lawyers, and you become those things that require you to step over into that other world. You know, that other world that you're unfamiliar with, and actually do battle.
Yeah, yeah. And so for you, when you came back home, did you immediately begin, or was it something that sort of percolated away for a while?
Oh, no, I was immediately, I engaged straight away within, I was here in 1985, and Kohangareo was thriving.
Yeah.
The early childhood movement for speaking te reo, and in the far north it was definitely thriving in Kaio. Nearly every marae, of which at that time there were 15 scattered within the Whangaroa area, well, they were there, their doors were open, the local tamariki were coming, and the kuia and elders were just delighted to say, oh, I've got permission to speak my reo to you, and I can share these songs and these waiata. And they just embraced it with so much aroha that we had a great time. I guess in those early stages of what they call the early childhood curriculum, the northern people looked at it and said, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to put a big fence around Kohangareo because it's not safe. And they said, but I brought up all my children here and they play in the river. And
yeah.
And oh, what do you think? Is that a good idea? It's a lot of money. And so, you know, we began that journey about meeting criteria. But in terms of the reo, it was very rich.
And so
very rich offerings.
Were there classes to attend, or were you just spending time with people?
No, you would go every day to the local marae. I went to Te Patunga,
yeah,
up the valley, where Auntie Ada was the main kaiako. And she would really teach very naturally of whatever. She was gifted. She was just gifted with, and many of them were the elders. Because that relationship to the mokopuna, because I was also had Fetu, my firstborn, with me, and, you know, she was only a few months old. And they embraced the mokopuna, the grandchild.
Mm.
So it was very easy for them to have a relationship and share and sing. Not easy, that's not the right word, but it was very natural.
Yeah.
Their love of grandchildren. And seeing that you would bring them and want to learn was very, very rich in what they shared with us, with myself.
And so there were.
So I embraced it, yeah.
Yeah, and there were plenty of people who could speak Māori.
Oh, like absolutely. During that time, you know, it was almost like, oh, I didn't know Auntie could speak te reo. You know, we'd have these conversations. I said, couldn't you? They said, nah, she never spoke it at home. Somehow it ignited that light within them again to feel that what gifts they had, they could they would be appreciated, because they were shut away, you know, their gifts of speaking the reo, because they thought, oh, no one's interested, I won't bother. And then the Kohanga Reo movement gave them this fantastic boost of confidence. And boy, did they. They wrote on wallpaper, as were our original, what you call, song charts were written on wallpaper.
Right.
And I'd even look for it today, because it's such a such a strong, you know, what I mean by wallpaper, it was, the words were written up and hung up on the walls inside the wharenui.
Yeah, yeah.
The main meeting house. And, you know, they always wrote them down. They always wrote down the words for you and were very patient. Their patience was extraordinary, putting up with us.
Well, I guess they'd waited so long to be able to do that that they would be patient.
Oh, there was great joy. Their great joy was to share the stories of the fact that you were inside the wharenui, and maybe the whare kai was going to be replaced, and it had a, well, they call them a dirt floor. Well, they call it a dirt floor, but it also became then a rammed earth floor, which it was.
Yeah.
Which was a very architectural name for, well, actually, the floor has been pounded so much, and it's basically a mud floor. And they were so warm. When we lost our last whare kai, which had a rammed earth floor, oh, there was a sense of loss, I think, because we were graduating to a wooden or a concrete floor, you know, a concrete pad was put down. And that was there was something in that change and architecturally that we mourned. You know, we said, oh, but we really like the floor.
Well, now it's the really, really fancy places that have rammed earth.
Yeah, that's right. And we were to learn that the methods, some of the architectural features of early Māori housing were actually adopted by, you know, middle class. They said, oh, I want one of those. I want a rammed earth floor. Mm. And we'd go, oh, yeah, that's a dirt floor. Yeah, I know. My auntie's got one back home.
Hey, I'm wondering, just listening to you talk about, like, there's a generation of people ready to teach. If it had gone on for another generation, would there have been many people around to teach te reo?
There would have been, but there was also a dying out. I think the whole, how do you say, the desire to have the reo, but also the other links to Western society were very strong, and also media, the social media increased. It began to increase at quite a speed. So the relationship of talking to each other, actually, I saw it happen very quickly. The younger generation were more connected to social media, to their phones.
So
the technology, the way that the reo was going to be delivered, was adapted to that platform, and the older generation really lost heart.
So that's more in recent times.
Oh, it happens so fast, and it's happening now. You know, you can be in the room, and you know, and when I was breastfeeding a young family, I would not have my phone on. I would not. I don't think I even had one. No, I didn't have a phone, a cell phone. But I definitely, you know, out of respect for my elders, I wouldn't have that technology in the room.
Yeah.
Now, it's not uncommon for all the elders to stand, one to stand and say, I want you to turn your phones off. This is a tangihanga. This is a funeral. And don't turn it on until the ceremony is over. Thank you. You know, asking us to behave and to be more conscious of being present.
Yeah, well, there's a whole story and a journey that yet to happen there, I think. But I want to go back to, you said when you first started learning that you had your first child had already been born?
Oh, yes, Fetu was born in the far north.
Yeah, so I presume Fetu and then following children became they were raised, or they went to school, or they went to Kohanga Reo.
And yes, then... I went to Kohanga Reo. We moved down to Kirikiri Roa so I could go to Te Whare Wānanga o Waikato, the university. And during that time, that also was just a absolutely rich experience of some of the best kaiako of te reo were present. The late Hidini Melbourne was teaching during that time. It was just such an incredible, fruitful time to stay connected to the reo. I was part of this. I was a founding member of Kohanga Reo at the Whare Wānanga, through the leadership of Charmaine Poutney. She came on board at the School of Education, and we basically, there was five wahine who had young children, walked into her office and said, "We want a Kohanga Reo on this campus." And she said, "Why isn't there one here? Right. Let's go and look for a site."
I know that name from somewhere. I don't
Charmaine
know where.
Poutney was a very strong, well-known feminist, and she became the head of the School of Education during that time, and we just marched in there, and she was, just open-hearted. She said, "Yes, and where do you think we should have our first, kohanga reo?" And she chose across the buildings across from the entry to the university marae, and that's how it began.
Right.
Through that initiative, and I was one of the founding members of that.
And you were there to watch it grow?
Oh, it now has a kura kaupapa Māori on Silverdale Road. It has done for many years. It blossomed. It was absolutely blossoming.
So was a kura kaupapa Māori available for your children? Was there a bit more work to do at that point to get that to happen?
Kura kaupapa Māori was definitely within the political arena. There were some very smart people working on, not just today, but the future.
Yeah.
And they could see the whole journey and the necessity to have that actually stamped and dated, made sure that it was set within the political arena, and that, it had to be honoured. The PICO report was part of that in 1989, that came through the government. And so the special schools, they were called special education.
Mm.
They were a formula that were used by private schools, Catholic schools.
Yes.
And then Māori said, "Okay, well, we want to be part of that. We want to be to kura kaupapa Māori. We want to have Māori, total immersion of Māori." And they went, "Oh, how are you going to do that? You can't have that. You can't have one language." I said, "Oh, well, we're already in a one-language school."
There was. I remember I was working in the building industry in the 90s for firms that did a lot of work in the education sector, and I remember being involved in lots of little projects, sometimes just expanding schools. There was a school over by Five Crossroads that convert from a state school, converted to Kura.
I was right there at that time. I was actually employed at Te Ararima.
Right.
That was probably the most interesting in terms of what I saw transition-wise.
Yeah.
It was quite sad for me, and I only say that because it was almost like it transitioned into a total immersion, yes, as you know. But all the literature that was related to learning English was thrown into these huge bins, like school journals, into these bins, because they weren't going to be used. That rich, what do you call, resource room where all the journals and the reading material. And I rescued some.
Okay. So there was quite a strong desire, like a real strength of feeling around that project.
I'm not sure. I just, myself personally, I had valued languages. Mm. And I thought, well, we can have both. But yes, the kura kaupapa Māori, because it's mainly predominantly a Māori community, and it will honour that fact. Whether you will attract the Māori community to fully support this kura, I didn't know All I knew was that the decision had been made, and this was how, you know, some of these stories would be unfolding and go forward. And I taught there, yes, I did teach there. It was, the transition was very, very challenging.
And there was a lot of fear in the some parts of the Pākehā community about this sort of thing happening as well.
Oh, totally. Those kōhanga reo children, as the years have gone on, who are now have almost grandchildren of their own, you know, they're still young, those graduates from those kōhanga reo and kura kaupapa Māori, are incredible leaders now, because their capacity to have two languages well founded within them, and to also relate to other indigenous languages, their respect for other indigenous languages is really clear, because they go, well, I've got mine, I've got my language, oh, okay, and your Cantonese, your Chinese, I will respect you if you speak to me in that language. I might not understand, but yes, you're very welcome to speak it.
And there was... There was. I mean, always with the changes that were going through, especially in the 80s and 90s, there was kind of some pushback, and there was, you know, the sort of nonsense you get on talkback radio about it. The immersion schools were going to raise a generation of radicals, and I remember reading an article after a few years where the commentary was that the people that were being produced in the schools, where they were coming out bilingual, and they knew their culture, and they were actually very grounded people. And that all the crazy fears were, you know, just wrong, basically.
Yes, they were. And, you know, those young people now lead. They lead in a whole myriad of fields. And there's a strong movement in filmmaking for Indigenous filmmakers. But they're bilingual, or they're definitely culturally tuned in to their worldview. I'm working with the cast and the crew, film crew from Ahikarua, and it's just incredible, their respect for each other and the way that they move around within that space. But that's come about, I feel, because of kōhanga reo and kura kaupapa Māori, the values.
Yeah.
That are embedded within that schooling system have definitely serving them very well as they go forward.
Was it hard to find enough teachers at that time? Like, there was a sudden rush of we're going to do this, and schools popping up everywhere. And I'm just, were there enough people to teach, I guess?
There were some pivotal leaders who really encouraged the many to go into teaching,
yeah,
and become qualified.
Yeah.
And they were very inspirational. Rose Petty was one of those. And it was almost like you went in with a pencil and a piece of paper, and you came out with a pencil and piece of paper. The resources weren't there and available, and you realised, oh my gosh, I'm qualified, and I actually have to make all my own resources.
And that's a big thing for people who aren't teachers. That's actually a big deal.
It was a big deal. You know, you were burning the midnight oil, because you're going, oh, I've got to teach them this tomorrow, and I don't have a resource room with Māori language resources that I have access to, and just go, oh yeah, there it is. There's the subject matter. I'll use that. It wasn't like that. You were burning the midnight oil. You had a glue. You had a some form of glue and a pair of scissors and some coloured paper, and you made up all these extraordinary.
And were you confident in your own language skills at that point that you could do the job?
Oh yes, yes, yes. It was. Oh, you were always. You were much more. I felt I was very on alert. If I could hear somebody speaking so fluently, I'd go, oh, I'm going to sit next to them at lunchtime.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to pick up whatever I can, you know. And you were always learning, or your desire to ask. You were asking, you know, You didn't sort of think, oh, I don't know. Oh, they'll think I won't know that. And I don't. You just took it on board as like, okay, well, that's my homework. I've got to learn that. I've got to find that out. And so you did. You asked. You made attempts to dig deeper and to see what was possible or what could be, how you could be this burden of not knowing some of the things you thought you should know. You thought, well, I never learned that at Teachers College. Okay, right, where am I going to go for that? So mainly librarians. They were my chief in the university sector schools. Yeah. Librarians are amazing people. They know so much.
And so did there come a point where you thought to yourself, now I'm bilingual now?
It was a gradual process, and there was always a feeling that you could learn more. It's you always, I think there was a time where you felt very comfortable with your own whanaketanga, your own development, but you were always aware that just over there, there was a, oh, they're really bilingual. They're total immersion. And you'd go, oh, okay, what does that mean? So you were aware of what was possible around you, but I definitely felt, a graduation, and it's still going on now today, graduating.
So, and I mean, I only speak one language, but I've known people over the years who speak languages. I mean, Europeans often speak, almost always speak two or three languages, and they talk about thinking in a different language. Were you able to get to the point where your thinking was happening in Māori, or does that not really?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah?
I definitely would have to acknowledge that I wasn't aware that was very much part of my nature, but because of my childhood and the way that my parents had the kaupapa that I'd carried in my childhood too, from them, their desire, their deep desire to be close to the haukainga and to their family marae, that has never left me. I always, although I'm in the city of Hamilton now, I feel I see it quite different. It's an urban jungle, and I'm here with a purpose and a kaupapa. Yes, it changed the way I saw the world, and that's very much part of how I go into the world each day as well.
So they say that there are some concepts that you can't really get a handle on unless you can speak the language, and this applies to many languages. Was that something that you found developed?
Yes, it is. It's something you become aware of when you work in an interface situation where we used to call it, there's this thing called Dialla Māori, which was Māori were called,
yeah,
or our elders were Dialla and Elder. There was a whole period of time, and it's probably still going on, where a mainstream organisation would ask for a kaumātua to do the opening prayer or do the opening whai kōrero, and that's it.
Yeah.
So it was just, oh yeah, okay, we've ticked that box. That's how it felt.
From my point of view too, it has felt like that.
Yeah, and so we in the Māori world would call that, oh, Daila Kaumātua, you going to be okay? There was a little bit of a relationship that we had with that way that we were seen, or we were perception of, oh, we'll get the elders to open, or, oh, they want a dawn ceremony. Oh, no. those relationships we felt were to be nurtured and to become an integral part of a community. However, they were also there was, they never really developed into a full-blown bicultural, bilingual relationship. And we saw that. We understood that. We didn't like it. And now we desire, you know, to have more of an integrated. We desire it, you know, because we know it's good for everybody.
And I'm kind of interested too in like, you know, when I'm wandering around, there's always chatter going on in my head and rehearsing lines. Sometimes I'm arguing with someone, you know, that sort of thing. Obviously, that's in English. So I'm curious if you noticed at a time when you started the inner chatter in your brain started switching over from English to Māori at some point.
Generally, I feel that I approach the world from a very indigenous understanding.
Yeah.
That's deeply embedded in within me. So I, if you like, that way of putting on that set of cultural glasses is always on, and it's when I take those glasses off, that cultural lens, I also see many other things, so in a universal sense. But that's part of my journey too, has been. But that came about through my culture, to see the world in a universal way. That's not peculiar to Māori. That's something that's part of Māori spirituality. It's quite normal for us to see the world like that. Well, I call it normal, but it can be washed out of you, so you don't relate to it, or you misinformed through social media about its content or what it is. And that's that rich whāriki, that mat of knowledge and that you've been given over the years to nurture you, not only outwardly but inwardly. And so you see, you know, or many things in that way that you think, oh, right, they don't do that. Okay. Yep. Oh, that's not good. Oh, let them know. You know, maybe sitting on a table, or just cultural things that seem natural and normal, and you go, hey, not good to sit on the table, eh? That's where you're going to have your kai. Mm. And they look at you and you go, what's that about? And they go, well, there's a big story, you know, about tapu and noa. And then you realise, oh, this is a whole way of viewing the world in a respectful way. And it served me well to have that knowledge given to me or gifted to me through universities, through being around the elders. All those different forums that I engaged with have been a rich tapestry of enabling me to understand that indigeneity. Mm.
And how does the issue of accents, because I've heard there's kind of different accents around Aotearoa. Was that an important thing while you were learning? And did you come to a different part of the country and, like, it's slightly different?
Yeah,
here?
Tainui were very strong on Tainui, and there were a lot of tūhoe kaiako teaching within Te Whare Wānanga o Waikato. So tūhoe had a strong influence, the tūhoe reo, and Tainui were very strong on all their waiata as well, the different forms of waiata that they sing. That's what they sung. That's what you were taught when you were there, you know, in those forums. And rightly so. Lion King is a very good example. The Māori version of Lion King has got dialectical differences. They pay attention to the different speakers who are actually speaking in the different dialects, because there are there are masters of those dialects who can offer that.
Was that something where people thought this dialect would suit this character, or was it just the person who was doing the speaking?
That's what I'm not sure how that was done, the Lion King, but I was thinking, oh, that sounds like fun. I've yet to actually see it, but I know that it's because I was told quite a bit about it when I was on a film shoot, how it was, you know, how they coached it or decided, okay, that voice, oh, that voice was, I think it was the speaker of that, if they were from, you know, Ngāti Porou or Kahungungu or the northern dialect, then they would be given that reo in that dialect. I thought, oh, that's cool.
That's actually, I didn't know that was happening with The Lion King. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and in The Lion King, it's all dialectical, yeah.
But it's just having a Māori version. It's now that I know about it, it's such the obvious thing to do because it's an animation.
And yes.
It's voiced anyway.
I think they would have had some fun. Mm. I would have loved to have seen the background story of them writing and promoting tūhoi, the reo from tūhoi or from Tainui, Waikato would have been just amazing.
Something else I'm curious about, which is completely independent of what we've just been talking about, but I spent a couple of years living in the Pacific Islands when I was like 12 to 14, and I didn't come away being able to speak fluently or anything like that, but I was aware that the languages throughout the Pacific, you go from Tonga to Samoa, and there's similarities and differences, and you can kind of follow the patterns of the language across the Pacific. So I'm wondering if you're listening to someone from Polynesia talking, or a Pacifica speaker, how much of that can you understand or kind of intuit?
Yes, my experience is limited in terms of that exposure, but I do know when I went to Rarotonga, I spoke to an elder whom I spent some time with, and we were sharing more in a very in a really, you know, this way of just sharing those differences of the reo and the similarities, and it's very easy to understand that language. Very recently in Whangaroa, actually just the other day, there was a musician who sung in a language. I actually asked, I said, what was that language? It was very Māori. He said, yes, it was from Peru.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
He was... these guttural sounds he was making, and then this reo that he was singing in, and he said, yes, you will find the words were the same. And I said, yes, I could hear that. I said, oh, how amazing. I said, so that's from Peru. And I said, oh, okay, I see. Yes, I can see the connection.
Yeah.
Because it was a strange language, but there were also familiar sounds, and he confirmed that, this musician, he felt that there was a very strong connection to Māori language. And I said, definitely, I could hear it.
That's really interesting, because there's been some kind of academic debate about the connection of Polynesians voyaging over to South America. But you can't argue with, if you can recognise the language, you can recognise it.
Yeah, well, there has been a significant amount of work that was done in the 70s. I'm just thinking of Richard Benton, of the way that particularly the vowel sounds and how they travelled through Asia as well, and the connection there for those language development. It came across the top of India, the Aryan people, many centuries ago, and came down through Peru and across to Easter Island and then into the Pacific. And so I guess so, carrying on from those sounds, because language is sound, he made significant connections to the origins of the languages. And there have been many other studies done too within the origins of te reo, and they go way back into the Aryan people across India.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah, it is really fascinating when you look at it. You can see movements of language across the Pacific, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yes, it is, because it's a whole other way of regarding the world, you know, like as well. that beautiful film, Te Whetū Marama, which was about the ancient navigational skills of the Pacific people. You know, they were speaking in a collective language, but it was also the subject matter. It was another way of viewing the world. So the words they were using would be unfamiliar to someone who only spoke English, because they spoke about the fish hook of Maui in the sky, and they would express that in the Pacific languages and in Maori. And it wasn't Greek, you know. It wasn't Greek language. It wasn't one of the gods, gods. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, that's because that's how Maori saw, the Pacific people saw the sky. That's how they viewed it. But it just wasn't on social media at that time and wasn't common, given out across the masses. And there's a reason for that. It can get diluted.
Yeah,
it's best you hear it first in person, then maybe other ways, and go from there.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, folks, we're talking to Ngaranoa Renata, and normally we talk indigenous plant medicine and things like that, but we do often talk language, and I just thought it would be interesting this morning to hear your kind of journey. And I didn't realise that how involved you were in Kura Kaupapa Māori, and...
Oh, yes, yeah, I had my eye on that very early on. When I graduated, I actually spent 2 years at, there was a transition period of Manga Kino.
Yes.
At the high school there, it went into transition. And that was a beautiful journey in a school, you know, that was struggling. But it was also very rich learning down there as an early trained kaiako, you know.
And you
totally supported by the local elders and
within
that environment. Mm.
And you still are teaching today? Was just
yes, I have not at a school. No. I'm choosing subject matter. So in Whangaroa on Wednesday mornings, the offering, and this is tomorrow morning, there is 2 waiata sessions. So we're offering the singing of waiata, both contemporary and those great numbers that everyone seems to know, the first line or the first verse. In the morning, there's a session for the mokopuna before 10 o'clock. They can arrive by 8:45, and it's just so beautiful to see them with their mamas coming in, that we started that last week. And then there's a pakeke session for adults, devoted to the adults, from about 10:30 to 12.
So is this open
to have some fun? Have some fun
is
singing.
This open to everybody.
Open to everybody. If you want to come for the whole morning, that's fine. But the morning session from 9 till 10 is really devoted to under 6-year-olds. But they can't, you know, they come with their caregivers, their kaitiaki or their parents, mātua. And in that way, we learn the reo through the music of the reo.
And where is that?
That's at the Old School Art Centre.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you got a little poster or anything like that? Did you do that?
Yes, I do. I have it on my computer.
Yeah, we could do with one here in the studio, I think.
I know.
Yeah, that'd be cool to have.
I will send that out today.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant. Hey, look, thank you so much for the conversation this morning. And I think the revival of the language is quite an endlessly fascinating story in so many ways.
Yes. It's just it's so good to just be able to sing the waiata and go, oh, yeah, I forgot, that line. Oh, yeah, you know, even the waiata offers so much joy.
So you don't have to be a fantastic singer either.
Oh, no, well, gosh, I mean, you've got me at the helm, yeah. So I'm not expecting, when Whetū comes out from Kirikiriroa, I have a sigh of relief. I say, Whetū, can you lead this waiata? Okay, Mama.
That's brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah, she's a songbird.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, look, thank you heaps for your time this morning, and yes, we'll hope to talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely.